fusing architecture, storytelling, and technology. This is Fusion, the Electrosonic Podcast, breaking down the art of engineering and creating lasting experiences through Pro AV. Hey everyone, welcome to Fusion, an Electrosonic Podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Litwin, the voice of B2B. So on this episode of the podcast, we're truly telling a story. We're getting the full narrative and a deep dive behind one of Electrosonic's most well-regarded and intricate projects. So picture a 13-hectare site housing a museum complex. We're talking 23 galleries. We're talking over 22,000 square meters, 800 exhibits, a 4D theater, a 1 million liter aquarium. I'm describing the critically acclaimed Sheikh Abdullah Al Salem Cultural Center in Kuwait, a project that was 5 years in the making, and none other than Electrosonic helped lead the effort of crafting the immersive, massive museum catalog. And just this year, they were awarded the 2019 Best Museum Project by Commercial Integrators Integration Award. A fantastic award. We're going to break down the honor of winning that award, as well as what did it take to conceive, construct, and launch such a massive endeavor, as well as some of the creative and technical choices that led to its success. So here to give their firsthand perspectives are Simon George, Senior Entertainment Consultant, and Narius Linauxis, Senior Project Manager for Electrosonic. Simon, Narius, welcome to Fusion. It's great to have you both on.
Thank you, Daniel. Great to speak to you.
Hi, Daniel.
All right, so let's start with that award. It's the most timely part of this whole project, and I'm sure it was a great feeling to win, obviously, an incredibly prestigious and well-regarded award in the industry. What did it take and what did it feel like to take home the gold?
Well, as you indicated in the introduction, which was a great introduction, by the way, personally, I've been involved with the project for 5 years, and so saw it from early conception right through to completion and indeed winning this award. So I felt very proud on behalf of the team that have worked on it. A number of different tasks and groups have worked on the project over that period, and I felt really proud for all of them that, you know, to win this award. It was a recognition of all the hard work and the skill and the knowledge that we brought to bear on this project.
I agree completely with Simon. This worldwide award is a recognition of our day-to-day questioning and innovation that we're striving for, and it is like a proof, actually, that what we're doing is we're doing something right or being recognized.
So Electrosonic was approached with the design initially in 2014. What was originally pitched your way, and how did you help guide the groundwork for the project? Because I know that since y'all were involved from the very beginning, you definitely had a focused hand in helping to craft the vision, what was realistic, and what was going to be most exciting about this museum project.
So yes, Daniel. So the way that it worked was Cultural Innovations, who were based in London, were employed by the client as the museum designers. So they had to come up with the storylines in each museum gallery, and the flow of those galleries and what the exhibits were going to look like and what the look and feel of the museums was going to be. And then they employed us, firstly as consultants, technical consultants, to look at, well, we've got this idea here. We'd like to do this. Is that achievable? And if it's achievable, how much is it going to cost? So we have, every project has a budget, of course. And so, yeah, can it be achieved? And can we do it within the budget? And sometimes there was a process where we would say, well, actually, if you did this slightly differently instead, it would work a lot better and it would be more cost effective. So that was a process that we went through at that concept stage, through all the galleries and all the museums. And indeed, there was another element to it. So we looked at the technical hardware. There was also a company called New Angle that were coming up with the media content. So there was Cultural Innovations doing the 3D exhibition design, New Angle coming up with the creative media content, and us with the hardware. And it was the three of us working together to come up with those initial designs and then specification leading from that, so that we had a strong basis to work from. And that was the first phase. And then the second phase from a design perspective, which sometimes gets missed, is that the buildings were going up. And quite honestly, because this was new to a lot of the architects and the main contractors, they hadn't considered really at that point that museums need very different infrastructure. And we're talking about cabling, we're talking about power requirements, we're talking about where control rooms need to go. So again, as the base build was going in, we got involved with specifying what cables were going to be needed, what power requirements were going to be, the control room requirements, because it couldn't be designed just like an office block, for example, and say, there you go, we've done the base build, now go and put the AV and put the museum together. That has to be integrated early on. So we got involved in that process. So that was the design. And so we had a design. There was a tender to a point. And then once we were awarded the systems integration part, that's then when we really got involved in the detailed design. And there were some changes in hardware and specification as we went along. But then Neris really got involved in deep diving into each exhibit and putting each exhibit together.
Yeah, that is correct. The overall idea when we got the project running was, as Simon is saying, to look into the details. And the first thing that we started looking in and applying technologies, which are like lead management, and we try to optimize integration, streamline installation, and basically identify repetitive processes, hardware. We basically try to unify as much as we can in order to basically automate all the day-to-day engineering that we would do for every single exhibit. But we wanted to see that on a global, on a bigger scale of the things, and to see how we can basically, instead of spending time as an engineer, automate that. So that would be done by a software.
What I love about projects like this, especially for integrators like Electrosonic, is I think it really showcases how the work of AV integrators has become way more than just a technical project. You really get to have that voice on the creative side of things, and you get to bring the technical perspective to that aesthetic and that creative vision. How did it feel being in that room, and what were some of the, either the physical or metaphorical room, right? And what was it like trying to blend your technical expertise into the more creative conversations, right? Where did y'all contribute, and how do you think that's reflective of maybe some changes in how integrators are approached in these creative conversations?
I think the key thing is that that's got to be understood is these people that are designing these museums are passionate about what they're doing, and you very quickly become passionate about the project and excited about the project, and that is really a key element. If you don't have that passion for it, then you're never really going to design something that you need to get under the skin of it and really appreciate what are they trying to say. Every museum, every exhibit is trying to say a message, and what are they trying to say, what are they trying to get across? And so it's a lot more than just, well, that's a projector there or it's a screen there. Ultimately, that's what we end up with, but it's really getting involved in that desire to help the creative process come up with something that looks wonderful and tells the story of what they're trying to get across. And I don't think you can fake that. Creative design people, they realize if you're really up for the project, really interested in it and what it's going to do and how it's going to work and all those sorts of things. So I think passion's the most important key of this development, really. And it all flows from there.
Yes, I agree completely. And the museum's main idea is edacology, is to plant a seed in somebody's mind and to educate people. And that understanding is really exciting. And, with a little bit of audio video augmentation, we can amplify that message to make it even stronger. And, you know, the main concept, yeah, is basically just to, you know, augment the what the designers have in their mind already. And audio video does help a lot.
And obviously the pre-production conversations here, you know, the conception conversations are some of the most important ones to be in the room for, to help craft those right stories with your designs. So when the integration actually began later in 2016, you were already familiar with the designs because you had been part of the project since 2014. But during that initial design and conception process in 2014, what were some of those requests from the team in Kuwait? And what were some initial things they asked for that, you know, maybe on one end you had to shut down or reframe to be more realistic? And what were some other ones that really, you know, sparked your imagination and got you excited and, you know, maybe had you innovating in ways you weren't expecting? So let's, you know, approach it from both ends, having to be pragmatic, but then also diving in and embracing some of that large vision.
So one of the, you know, the negative pragmatic element was there was some ideas about projecting outdoors and projecting on the buildings, which can be done. It's very, very challenging in somewhere like Kuwait because of the environmental conditions you're faced with. Obviously, it's very sunny and very hot. And really, that only works, that sort of projection only really works outdoors at night. And so it was really decided that in the end, that wasn't a particularly good use of investment, you know, return on the investment. So that was, and it'd be better to use that money for indoor to strengthen the indoor elements of the project. And, you know, because actually it is an indoor experience, you know, in that part of the world, that's what they're looking for. You know, you can't go outdoors in the middle of the day in the summer. So it is an indoor experience. So that was one element that we looked at. And then I think Neris can talk a little bit about this, but we got really excited about the idea of having a little bit of a theme park ride in a museum, which is moving seats and very immersive projection. So I think it's called Virus Attack, and it tells the story of going through the human body, but you are sitting in a moving seat as you would do in a theme park, which is quite unusual for a museum. But a great way of combining sort of entertainment and, you know, education at the same time, which is one of the key things you're trying to do in a museum environment, actually. If you can combine those two things, then it's a win-win. And Neris can talk a little bit, I think, about some of the challenges of putting, 4D seats in that museum environment.
Yes. So as Simon is suggesting, you know, there are beautiful ideas and there are some actual, comes to pragmatic point of view, we have to evaluate everything, how everything will work. So we had to wipe off the, you know, dust from the old books of physics. We had to check the Newton laws of motion, and we have to evaluate whether the seats whether the structure will hold motion of the seats. That was almost half of the ton of movement, which was able to achieve about 1G of the acceleration. So the structure itself was a 30-foot sphere, almost in the middle of the space, and the cinema was inside the sphere itself. So not only we had to look into the acoustics, sound absorption, we had to look at the structural rigidity to make sure that when visitors are walking outside, they can't hear, they can't even sense what's happening inside. Although, you know, visitors inside the theater were experiencing, you know, loads of 1G. Yeah, and it was, yeah, I think if I remember correctly, we were peaking about 120 decibels sound pressure level wise. So it was loud and it was really exciting. I mean, you would never expect that in a museum, but as Simon is suggesting, it is a part of edacology, I guess. So
yeah, that's right, it's combining those things. Yeah, and it's a really good exhibit. I really like that.
Yeah, to be fair, I don't think there's anything else around like that. The other tricky, the other technical problems that we experience is basically making sure that it works. It's really hard to describe how much energy and how what particular torques and how much reinforcement had to be built around and how many revisions we actually went through all the structural assessments, finishes, everything. It is relatively complicated. So not on top of that, we were doing air compressors, dishwashers or goggle washers, which is not typical audio video stuff. It was something.
Yeah, it was definitely something, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good way of describing it.
Right, exactly. It was something. I mean, hey, but those kind of projects, I think, are what really help push the mantle forward for the industry. Because, like I said, I think they're representative of how the AV industry is becoming more than just AV. You're becoming full system integrators. You're leaning more into, new tech realms as well as creative ones, and you're having a seat at the table for both of those. And you're now expected to be able to deliver both creative ideas and creative solutions as well as innovative technical solutions that might go beyond the AV mantle. Do you feel like that's accurate? Do you feel like the industry, especially when you look at a project like this one, is being pushed into new directions?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The key thing on this, on a lot of the Middle East projects, and I don't know if you've considered this, but they, because of their culture that in the centuries gone by, they were basically nomadic peoples, so they don't actually have many, if any, artifacts. So actually, when you design these museums, you don't have lots and lots of artifacts that you can put in. So they are really reliant on digital technology to tell the stories, which is great and really exciting for us. But it also means you really do have to push the boundaries, because you don't have a physical object there. That's exciting. So some of these projects are really exciting. And it changes the dynamic in some respect, because if you have as we do in the UK, have lots of museums that have lots of artifacts, then, and there's nothing wrong with this, but the technology is being used to enhance the story. Whereas in some of these environments, there are no artifacts, so the technology is having to tell the story from A to Z. So it's much more in depth.
And there is another point of view, I guess, to delivering this type of project. Again, because of the IT or informational technology and the scale of the project, it became obvious that actually we have to look at delivering project in a different way. So algorithms, automation, that's just only to make the delivery possible. The timeline was really tight and it was just too much work. And, we decided actually to see to explore the ways how we can automate everything, to make it a little bit faster, to make it more consistent. There's a lot less of a chance of having a mistake and more the chance of having more unified solution and delivery of everything. So
let's fast forward to integration. Once the conception process was more or less over, integration came around in 2016. It became clear, okay, now this project has a time-sensitive deadline, and it was a lot shorter of a deadline than you were expecting. So was it overwhelming to find out that you had just under 2 years to deliver this whole project, or was the team relatively optimistic from the get-go? What was the response? How did you try to mobilize to get this done?
So I think Neris will expand on this more than me because he was in the heart of the delivery. But we did have the biggest advantage. We get involved in some projects where we haven't designed it. So we don't know as much about the project as we could. But on this project, at least we knew exactly what we were doing. What we'd specified was correct. It was specified in the way that we understand. As I said earlier, the cabling infrastructure was done and in place. So all these things really were of benefit. And although it was still a huge challenge to get it done in the time, you've got that confidence behind you that we're off to a good start, which isn't always the case. If something's been badly designed by somebody else or not designed at all, then you're on the back foot before you even start. But in this case, we knew we had a good design. We knew we had the infrastructure in place. So it was really not to be underestimated, but it was really mobilizing the engineering team and, you know, delivering the project. So we were very optimistic from the start, but we appreciate there was a huge amount of work to be done.
Yeah, same with my colleagues and our delivery team. We are all optimistic and we have a can-do attitude. But early in the project, we saw that we had about 5,000 items, about 1,400 side cables, about 50 network switches, 45 hardware racks, 282 kilowatts of power consumption. It became obvious to us that we have to look at the ways how we can make it more efficient and how we can actually get a grasp of all what we're doing, because the scale, it was just too big for engineer to actually get a grasp of, you know. So we tried to improve all the processes, all how we work. We did, as mentioned before, we did use a lot of automation. We did write our own software in Python and C#, just for the project itself. It moved on and on. That was the way we actually managed to do that on time.
Yeah, I mean, some of the simple things that we do, well, they're simple to us, but they're not, and obvious, but they're not always the case. So once we'd done the design, all of the central equipment racks were built in and tested in the UK with all the equipment in them, so that we knew that we had core systems that were working, rather than turning up on site with a load of empty racks and a load of kit that never been tested and trying to install it all there and then. So, you know, we tried that off site and we'd done that. So we knew we had the basis of a working system, and that saves so much time when you're on site, when working conditions aren't always perfect and you're up against the clock. So that really helps as one of the things that we did. The other things that we did, when you have to interface with other contractors, so there are set fabricators who were building the set work, and we had a little bit of a logistical challenge because we had several different contractors in different parts of the world working on this in different galleries. And so simple things, apart from providing drawings to interface to them, we also provided them with sample hardware so they could see that or check that our AV was going to fit into their set works way before we get to site. And you know, that cuts down on other problems. And the same with the media content, the people that were writing or delivering the, whether they be video films or interactive computer programs, again, we provided them with hardware so that they could test what they were producing would actually run on the hardware that was going to be installed. So again, that's another huge time saver, because you don't want to get to site and then find what they produce won't run on the hardware. So there's little tricks like that that we've learned over the odd 50 years that we've been in business that, you know, that helps us streamline really that delivery process.
Yeah, I agree with Simon completely. And just to give a rough numbers, we had a six set separate companies building exhibit hardware. So that's six, multiply everything by six. So although it is easy to grasp on a regular type of project, having this one, we had two, three software companies, six setwork companies, and we, you know, the management turned into quite a big project management task on its own to make sure that everybody have a set of hardware. And on top of that, we have enough hardware to do installations on site in the museum, where we had 20 engineers at that time. So it was intense, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're bringing all this up, because I wanted to get into some of the logistical challenges and the ways that you overcame those as well. So, you know, the first one being, even though Electrosonic was part of the conception process in 2014, when it finally came to integration, it was such a large project that, you know, it wasn't just possible for one integrator to make it happen. So your team took three of the six blocks, and then two other companies took on the other three blocks at the museum exhibit. So how did you aim to keep consistency and quality among not only your three blocks where you had the majority of the responsibility, but also the other three, right? Collaborating with those other integration companies and helping maintain the standards across different companies, different exhibits. That way, the final product was still reflected well on Electrosonic.
Yeah, so actually that worked. It's quite interesting because we're competitors, but we actually worked really well as a team together on this project. That was quite interesting. So firstly, there was a very good relationship between all of us. Secondly, obviously we designed and specified all of the hardware, including makes and manufacturers of equipment, and we all stuck to that. And if anybody had an issue with something, they'd bring that up and say, hey, we're having a challenge here. So there was a continuity of equipment across the museums, which is really important. You know, you don't want different products. It makes life easier for the client in terms of maintenance and in terms of spares. And so that was important. You know, those two items were very important. The client did have their own gatekeeper, who we do know, who was a technical consultant, and they were also ensured that all the drawings, so everything that we did, you didn't just go and build it. You had to submit drawings to be approved. And that again ensured that there was a level, quality level was there, really.
Yeah, the collaboration was like nothing else I ever worked on. It is correct. It is our competition, but we all had the same aim, which is basically to make this biggest museum in the world or finish this biggest museum in the world. And it was really interesting. And I would say that it's one of the best experiences, actually, just working together and analyzing each other's suggestions and really objectively and coming up with the best solutions we can. So in order to save time and make this, you know, delivery more efficient. So that was, yeah, it was great. It was definitely great.
Do you think this project is reflective of maybe how the industry should approach collaboration moving forward? Because obviously competition is important. You know, it's important to be, or to aim at least, to be the best in your industry, right? But sometimes these projects are so large that you literally cannot take them on alone, and you have to team up with companies that, like you said, are your competitors. So yeah, I mean, do you think the kind of standards that y'all set in place here, what you were able to achieve, is reflective of maybe how the industry should approach or look at partnerships with competitors for larger projects?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the media producers had to do the same thing. So they had to have a similar look and feel to the content that they produced. So I think you're right. I think one raises the standard on the other. So I think it definitely, you know, is a good thing, you know, and I wish there were more projects of this size, frankly. But yeah, it worked really well, I think.
So I think beyond this, the biggest hurdle for this project on a logistical level was that you had to have a crew stationed in Kuwait for a long period of time. So, you know, you had two different hubs, you had Kuwait and you had the UK. And you had to have a fluctuating number of engineers depending on the need, but obviously still delivering on the creative and technical solutions, having project managers, having the consultation available. So it was a big logistical challenge. To set yourself up for success, how did you source materials and AV samples needed to ensure that once your crew was on site, it would be a success? You know, what were some of the logistical choices you had to make to make sure the materials and the hardware were all there, so it wouldn't be a back and forth?
So just another slight step back from that, Daniel, in the way that we work. So there's several levels of installation. So we have what we call first fix installation, and this is really where we're just putting up brackets. So at this point, it may not be a clean site, maybe still dusty, but we're putting up brackets, infrastructure. But at this point, no actual expensive equipment is going in. It really is that first level infrastructure. And so there's a team that does that, an installation team. And obviously what they need is that first is metalwork predominantly. Those first elements that they and bracketry and all that type of thing that they're going to put in. So that's your first stage on site. Then as the site becomes cleaner, air conditioning definitely needs to be on, then we can start installing the equipment. And it's quite often the same team that will do it. So that's the next stage. And then at that point, we need to get the equipment to site. And so that can often be done in phases. I don't know if Neris knows. I must admit, I don't know exactly how we phased it. You can talk about how it was phased.
Yes, Simon. It was phased because of the sheer scale of the project and amount of the exhibits and galleries we had to work on. So we had to split the shipments into two major parts, if I remember correctly, almost three. But the idea was actually we had to make sure that we have enough hardware so the installation on site goes on and there's still enough hardware for the furniture or separate manufacturers to do their modeling and for the software developers to write their own software as well. So that was all staged accordingly, and we were really careful with our steps, how we do that. And there was one stage in the project where it was, I'd say, a peak stage of the project where it was about 20 engineers doing installation on site. The museum hardware, all the AV racks, everything were switched on. We set up the remote access. Software engineers were installing the final versions of the software remotely from all across the world. So the museum works were going 24/7, and it was not only UK, the software was produced around the world as well. So it was great.
No, so I think that's an important element, wasn't it, Neris, that capability to be able to upload software remotely really helped.
Yeah. Again, it was the steps taken just in order to deliver the project on time. We had to work out the best ways and methods, how we could do that, how we could stage everything, how we set up, how we program the project itself so it runs smoothly. So there were some really big overlapping tasks around.
Yeah. Well, and let's not ignore the physical conditions too that kind of helped limit what you could do and you know pose their own challenges. So I know often you had crews working in degrees of over 50 degrees Celsius, which can be a little steamy, to put it lightly. So I'm sure that presented another layer of difficulty.
Yes. Yeah, can you talk about that, Neris? I wasn't so involved. I mean, I think at the most point the buildings were the air conditioning came on fairly early. It's actually the scale of the size of the site, and obviously you're walking from one building to another outside, or from the site office, and that can be draining in itself. So you certainly have to make sure you're hydrated.
Yes, that is correct. So the Middle East temperatures, they can be exhausting and melting, literally melting. 50 degree centigrade is enough to melt windshield wipers. So you have to make sure that you're well under the shadow, well hydrated. And as Simon was saying, walking through from gallery to gallery or from block to block, that can be exhausting on its own. It could only be a 5-minute walk, but you know, you want to avoid these. So it's a good thing that actually it's not the first project we're working in Middle East. And we always insist having air conditioning in the spaces. So usually it's fine.
We're a bit sad. We worry about the equipment sometimes more than we do ourselves.
Right. Right.
We can't put that equipment in that control room. You haven't got it down to 21 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
It's constant.
Right. Simon, you also mentioned so just some customs in Kuwait that influenced a bit of how you worked. I'm not sure if y'all can break that down at all or give us some insight, but I know that, I mean, obviously, working on international projects, you're often met with different cultures and different ways of approaching work or just being in the general area that I'm sure impacts logistically how you approach the project.
Yeah, so obviously the key thing is you have to be a little sensitive, particularly during Ramadan. You're allowed to eat and drink as a non-Muslim, but you have to be sensitive where you do that. So, you know, that's a key difference. And you have to
just to pay respect to the culture and generally the area where you're in.
Yes. So you wouldn't. So if So if you're walking about, you wouldn't just necessarily be eating or drinking
right,
in public
right.
at that time. So you just have to be a little bit sensitive to that. And you tend to slightly have different work patterns as well. Quite often that they'll, because it's so hot, you might have to start work at, which is sensible, start work at very early in the morning and then finish at lunchtime or whatever because of the heat.
Yes, and there's also an element of not taking pictures of the mosques. Don't do that. Not worth it.
All right, so during the integration process, what were some unique technical solutions that you delivered to really amplify the end user experience and deliver on that complete immersion? You know, walk us through some of the final steps that you had to take to put the final touches on some of these projects. And you know, feel free to pick some specific ones. I'm sure our audience would love to hear some of the specific exhibits that you had a hand in creating.
Yes, so Whole Museum was based, all the galleries were based on the idea that every gallery would have its own prime or the biggest exhibit. And usually these exhibits would be in the beginning of the gallery or on the end of the gallery. And one of those key ones, I would say, was an animatronic exhibit with a 10 feet tall robot, which was basically, its movements were synchronized with the content in 48 LED monitors, and it synced with 10 channels of audio. So the trick was obviously for us to create an interface which would allow dual redundancy between the robot, automation, and audio-video systems, and that interface would serve the purpose of a critical synchronization and visitor safety. The robot was huge, and we had to make sure that actually it's absolutely safe for the robot to show its movements and do the presentation of the gallery. I think another interesting exhibit that we done was a 60-foot length exhibit where visitors were allowed to race against the fastest sprinters in the world. So that exhibit was based on 16 80-inch portrait LED monitors, and we had to fuse multiple sensors, motion sensors, RFID sensors, effect lighting, and audio system to create this interactive where literally you would basically race best times during a day and race the best sprinters in the world.
So you had a long screen, essentially, that simulated how fast someone like a Usain Bolt or a leading Olympics sprinter could sprint at, and you would then try and pace yourself against that. So you would run down and see how far ahead they were of you, which was a really nice idea.
All right, let's wrap this up by talking about the reception of the project. Once the doors were opened, what your contemporaries were telling you about it, your colleagues, obviously the team in Kuwait that commissioned the project. So the doors opened in March of 2018, and it's now the biggest innovative museum in the world and has become a central supporting arm of not only Kuwait tourism, but also just the general Kuwait economy. So go ahead and fill in the audience with some of the initial reception by the AV community specifically when this project was completed, and then we'll break down some of the local reception as well.
So again, I think it was fairly unique, you know, the AV reception of all of us, of three companies working together on it, and the media companies who in their own sense call themselves AV, although they're looking at the content side. So I think there was a little bit, oh, I wish we were involved in that. If a company hadn't been involved in the project, you know, and how much had been delivered in that time. So there was a little bit of envy but I think that in general, though, it was very well received by the AV community, who thought, you know, this is a fantastic project, fantastic showcase for what we do, because there is a, you know, what you provide is putting a TV on the wall, and some people can think like that. And so this was a showcase for the AV community to show that, no, there's an awful lot more to what we do than that.
So I was fortunate enough to see the museum open to public itself, and it's really hard to describe how immersive it is to overall public. It's called Cultural Center, and for a particular reason, it's open for public. Young families are gathering together. The kids have opportunity to go explore museum exhibits while parents can have a chance to sit down, have a cup of coffee and socialize. And it is really great attraction center.
And then what about for the local economy and the people that commissioned this project? Were they pleased with the final vision? Was it what they were expecting? Was the dream completed? And if so, what were some of those initial responses?
Yeah, they were delighted with the result. And the whole key to this is that they want to open up their economies a little bit more and be more attractive to communities and people outside of the country. And that's one of the... So, there were two key aims, as I say, to provide something for the people of Kuwait that they can be very proud of and be of educational value as well. But also, secondly, to increase the tourism to the country and open the country up to visitors and say, hey, this is something you can go and see. And on both those levels, the reaction we've had has been very, very positive. And those aims have been achieved.
And then just from a larger industry perspective, since you won such a prestigious award, I feel like this project is in the AV mainstream. It's part of the conversation. And I think you were able to set a lot of quality standards for the industry, whether you meant to or not. So what sort of project standards do you think that Electrosonic set with the Sheikh Abdullah Al Salem Cultural Center in Kuwait? And why do you think it's important to view projects of this size in that kind of industry affecting way?
From my personal perspective, being a lead engineer, I'd say that actually it was the first big transition of AV into IT. We did use a lot of informational technology to deliver this project. This was the only way we could scale it up and achieve this consistency and basically overall quality of standard of how the system is working and is being commissioned.
Yeah, and there were certain elements you did as well, Neris, weren't there, that you introduced into this that we could use going forward, and I think others could?
Yeah, so we did use a lot of our informational technology. So workload, timesheets, we used geofencing for that. We wrote the software to configure the switches automatically. We automated interactive computer backups. We used extensively online document depositories, so no printed papers, no printed drawings. Everything was on a cloud. All the installation engineers had laptops. We had a Wi-Fi through across the museum blocks. Collaboration was literally smooth because museum was too big, so it was easier to make video calls, and make sure that everything is running smoothly.
And I think, an interesting point there that it's been going on. We've been talking about this for 15 years, but this project just show that how integrated IT is becoming within to the AV as well. It's becoming as one. And we couldn't have delivered some of this project without some of the IT tools. So I think in terms of standards, we're seeing the merging of IT and AV. As I say, it's been talked about for a long time, but it is actually happening, and this is a good example of that.
All right, Simon, Narius, thank you both so much for joining us on this episode of Fusion. It was a pleasure getting to break down the creative and technical and logistical challenges that came with creating the largest innovative museum project in the world. I think y'all should be very proud of what you put together. Obviously, the industry seems to agree with the awards that you're winning for this. But I think even from just a local perspective, seeing the kind of impact that this can have on Kuwait tourism, on the Kuwait economy, is all fantastic. And to see that AV work, both the technical side and the creative side, can have such an impact on a local community and on an entire country is pretty fantastic. So, Simon, Narius, thank you both so much for joining us. It was a pleasure again to break this down.
Thank you, Dan. It was a pleasure to talk to you as well.
Thank you, Daniel.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to today's episode of Fusion, an electrosonic podcast. And if you like what you heard and want to listen to previous episodes, you can head to blog.electrosonic.com/tag/podcast. You can also find our podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And make sure you leave a rating and a comment wherever you're listening to your podcast content. I'm your host, Daniel Litwin, the voice of B2B. Till next time.